Well, hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Sessions G. This is episode 7, and we are here today with our third psychedelic session of this season. We have an amazing guest, a very interesting story, and I'm so excited to hear more and more. So excited to have you here. Welcome, Trad Mystic.
Thank you. So is it my turn to say a little bit about myself?
It sure is. Yes, please introduce yourself.
I am the last person you would expect to find in the, you know, kicking around the psychedelic community these days. I have spent most of my 63 years as I describe it as a traditional mystic. I am not a member of a particular religion and therefore don't belong specifically to a religion and can't say, oh, I'm, you know, this sort of thing. But traditional in the sense of traditional practices, very straight edged. You know, about the strongest thing I've consumed most of my life has been caffeine in the form of tea. Coffee was too strong for me. So I'm the last person you would expect. But I'm also someone in a wheelchair with pretty severe arthritis. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the many pain patients who were treated with pain meds. And we seem to have this passionate desire to swing from one extreme to the other, especially with regard to substances, and never quite settling around the moderation point. So initially, you know, it was, oh, you have a hangnail. Here's some OxyContin. And then, of course, they went to the other extreme of, oh, your limbs are falling off. Take an aspirin. And as I was getting thrown off the meds I had been using for probably over a decade. And I might add, using and not abusing, the mythology that, oh, if you're on pain meds, you're an addict is part of the let's swing from one extreme to the other routine. Mm-hmm. But as I began to assess the situation, I knew I was going to be thrown off these meds. I looked around, thought, what am I going to do? I still need to be able to transfer out of my bed, in the morning, stuff like that. And I realized the one thing that was open to me was the medical marijuana program in my state. Mm-hmm. Now, I had no experience with marijuana. And to cut to the chase, fairly early on, I ran into a strong edible.
Okay.
Which was definitely an experience for me. In fact, I was actually sitting in about this position close to it when I found myself dealing with my first hallucinogenic substance. And I guess it, you know, in some ways it seemed rather like, you know, a wild and woolly brain explosion. Mm-hmm. But out of the whole thing, in, you know, all of that, something very odd happened. An insight popped out. And I was like, puzzled almost after the fact, because, you know, of course, I was firmly convinced, and I had a close student at the time who had come to mysticism through a period of using psychedelics, and I'd always been dismissing everything that the student said as, oh, this is delusion, you know, oh yeah, that delusion, illusion, you know, that's what drugs do. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, here is this countervailing data point, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
I had been doing something wrong. I had gotten very snippy about something and was screwing over some friends, you know, not in any major way, but it was certainly not well motivated. And I, you know, once I saw it right there in front of me, just sort of popping out in the midst of all the mayhem that was going on in my head, I couldn't avoid it. That here was an insight, and it was mediated by a drug.
Yeah.
So it was time to sit down with my student and say, okay, it's my turn to learn. What can you tell me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it became very clear the only way I was going, that I really did need to understand what was going on with psychedelics. I mean, it was an important thing for me to learn. And there's only one way to learn, and that's to take. Mm-hmm. And so began my experiment of both learning not just simply about the drugs, but also learning about the community that evolved around them. And that's been my adventure. And as I think I was telling you earlier, in some ways, I'm a little bit skeptical about it. And in other ways, I am really almost furious at how psychedelics are portrayed, you know, in the general, I guess, the, you know,
in
the
general mainstream.
Yes. The general mainstream opinion of psychedelics could not be farther from the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, if you listen to the media, and certainly I did, and listen to the government propaganda, and certainly I did, for, you know, years, you'd be of the impression that people go crazy on psychedelics. They're bad for mental health. They are dangerous drugs. They only produce illusions. Mm-hmm. They produce delusions of spiritual grandeur and something like that. You know, people end up in psych wards out of them. Destructive, destructive substances. Whereas if you actually start looking at what's going on, you see something quite different. Mm-hmm. What you see, first off, is there are far, far more people who are using and came to psychedelics specifically to address their mental and emotional issues. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many times I've heard the story of, I was suicidal, I had given up on life, somebody offered me, I don't know, LSD or something. I just took it because I figured, what the hell, I'm going to kill myself tomorrow. And my whole life changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or, you know, I came back from the war, I had PTSD, I just was ready to shoot myself, and I tried psychedelics, and now I have a new lease on life. Mm-hmm. I have heard the stories of people who've said, well, I got deep into psychedelics, I was using them every few days, I took 2,000 micrograms of acid and 10 grams of shrooms, and went crazy and ended up in a psych ward. That does happen, you know, and that's not surprising. They're tools. And if you play with a power tool badly, you will end up in a hospital too. Mm-hmm. You know, so by far, the more likely stories, the more common stories seem to be that, and indeed consistent with research, that these drugs are effective drugs for the treatment of a lot of mental illness.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, they are, you know, not devastating by far. They're not even what I imagined them to be. I guess part of me imagined you take a psychedelic, there's a sudden massive break with reality. And well, certainly at certain doses, there really is a massive break with reality. By and large, the doses most people are using most of the time, they're still very much aware of their tripping, they're aware of their environment, they're capable of holding conversations, albeit perhaps not wanting to sometimes. Mm-hmm. Just everything about the drugs are portrayed as terrifying. And the main reason, of course, according to the whole mythology of it, is that people are using them to get high.
Right.
And in fact, while you certainly can experience euphoria through them, you can also experience plenty of dysphoria. Or nothing else, you know, or really mood, something that really doesn't affect one's mood, but is simply affecting one's thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all of that. That's why these conversations are so exciting for me and why I really wanted to have more and more of these. It is definitely in part to just connect with people that have had similar experiences and are having dialogue around these things as well. To dispel a lot of those myths around what psychedelics are portrayed as. And I agree with you. There's definitely a group of people that perhaps use it to party and things like that. And I've certainly done that younger days. But the larger group, the majority of psychedelic people that do work with psychedelics are people that are doing it from that place of wanting to address those mental or emotional issues. Mm-hmm. And at some point, that journey, I found, at least in my case, that becomes a journey on its own. And it becomes less about those issues and more about just being in communion with these plants for the ones that are naturally occurring, just mm-hmm. being in communion with them. And being able to build a relationship and sort of develop that and understand them and see them for what they are and really just build a relationship. So, yeah. And so I'm very interested in knowing. So you went to your student and you said, hey, you know, so first of all, you had this insight that sort of came out of nowhere for you. Really piqued your interest. So you go to your student and you say, hey, I'm ready to learn. What is there for me to learn? So then what happened? What did you start off with?
Well, let's see. We discussed the various drugs and I think I sort of tentatively said, okay, I think I will attempt some mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And did this really, I guess she was somewhat, well, for a number of reasons I don't want to get into because at that point I'm going to be potentially identifying someone who is a well-known figure. So I am afraid I have to omit some of the details here, but we did it very gradually and just sort of worked from, we started out with, I felt a little bit at that point like it was a mutual experiment. I guess I was the lab rat. Started out with microdosing, and I think that does make sense to start small, because one of the things she told me is that some people are extremely sensitive to psychedelics, mm-hmm. and if you know a microdose is a full trip for these people, and mm-hmm. Jumping in at what everybody else says is a beginner's dose may not be the wisest tactic. So we started with microdosing, and tell you the truth, the first thing I noticed with microdosing, and it again pretty much surprised me, was that with microdosing, I could sort of jump to where it might take me an hour or two of meditation almost immediately.
Wow.
Which surprised me that it would have that much effect for something I didn't feel.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually, of course, the doses got a little higher. And I am finding that I respond somewhat atypically to these drugs. There's a lot of possible explanations for that. But nonetheless, you know, if you push hard enough, I eventually get, I'm sort of the opposite. I'm somewhat insensitive to these drugs.
Okay.
I'm almost afraid to tell people what I've taken, because it's something I want to tell people, don't do that. You know, mm-hmm. I am the exception here. Please do not follow my route.
So when you say atypical, you mean to say that it takes quite a high dose for it to have a significant effect on you?
Yes, it does. I don't know why. I've got a few hypotheses. It doesn't really matter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just the doses. I'm also exploring the community around it,
mm-hmm.
and the attitudes towards it, and what are people doing with this, you know, these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how many times I wish I could drag the world to a meeting of the local psychedelic society and listen to people talking about this.
Yeah.
Because I would love to drag all the world's, you know, anti-druggers in there and just let them listen and let them hear what is so unlike the public story, you know, the official, this is what psychedelics are.
Yeah. What kinds of communities have you come across so far?
I've been, you know, COVID being COVID, everything seems to be virtual these days.
Yeah.
So I am everything from Zoom meetings of the local psychedelic society to, I spend a lot of time on some of the Discord servers. I was part of some of the web-based communities, which I have to say I've kind of drifted away from. I find that one of the problems with a web-based community in general is that when people want to have an argument, it sits there in perpetuity and sort of takes on a life of its own, whereas a chat room, it disappears.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps things a little more civil over time. So, you know, a random assortment of what I could find on the internet, since nobody's really going anywhere right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you started off microdosing mushrooms and you slowly upped the dosage. And then what happened? Did you pivot to other psychedelics, or have you stuck to mushrooms?
Yes. I have now also used... Actually, one of these is a very interesting discovery I found myself. I've also used LSD, which I seem to be extremely resistant to. Basically, it makes me a little bit dumber and a little bit cheerier, and that's about it. At any dose I have tried, I think my maximum dose was 550 micrograms, so it's not for lack of trying.
Right.
I don't know why I'm particularly resistant to LSD, but I am.
Mm-hmm.
Much less so with mushrooms. I can actually get psychedelic effects out of mushrooms. And I have tried DMT, and in particular, I have tried pharmawaska, which became quite a surprise to me. because I was going, okay, this is a, you know, I'm going to try this because this is part of the, I'm not willing to purge. So, you know, I'm not
right.
willing to go the classic ayahuasca route. I'm a bit of a wimp, I guess. But I guess I was not expecting anything that would have a physical healing effect. That was like mm-hmm. the last thought in my mind.
Yeah.
One of my joints had become completely frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really, I mean, it would have been seen a long time ago by an orthopedic surgeon were it not for the joys of COVID and the local hospital being, you know, putting us kind of as a lower priority
mm-hmm.
for obvious reasons. If you've got somebody dying and you've got somebody whose limbs which are already pretty dubious, you know, one of them is frozen, you'd expect, you know, that's a prioritization I would sign off on. But I was shocked. I was able to lift that limb. I was able to move it afterwards.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, how did this happen? Later on, I've read something, read a few things that suggest that DMT is an immunomodulator and a modulator of inflammation,
mm-hmm.
which means that it may not be the first thing you're going to look for, you know, in the way of an arthritis drug, but it's a spectacular one. I can't say I've had an effect of that dramatic with anything short of some fairly heavy-duty steroids.
Mm-hmm. And before you go any further, sorry, what exactly is pharmawasca? I'm familiar with ayahuasca.
Okay. It is the active ingredients of ayahuasca refined. So in other words, instead of using Psychotria viridis or an analog like the root bark, you actually extract the DMT.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of using the kapi plant, the ayahuasca vine, or even Syrian rue as an analog, you obtain extracted harmalas.
And what's the difference between that and DMT? Because I thought that
one of them
DMT.
Is DMT. One of them is most certainly DMT. If you extract the DMT from mimosa bark, you certainly are going to have DMT, and that is a component of this. So basically, mm-hmm. you have one component is the DMT, the other component is the harmalas.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
You could either combine them in a capsule or separate them out and just sort of consume them one after the other at a set of timing, which tends to be what I do. But either way, you're basically taking the active ingredients of ayahuasca without taking the extraneous plant matter that tends to encourage purging.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. So, okay. And was your DMT experience fairly similar to that pharmawasca?
Inhaled DMT is a different beast. It really does seem quite different.
Mm-hmm.
I am still not quite sure. I think of the two, I vastly prefer pharmawasca. Inhaled DMT tends to have sort of this quality of being this massive rush of weirdness, mm-hmm. and then you're back home again, as it were. And I suspect that all that is just a little bit too fast for anybody to work with it, frankly,
mm-hmm.
you know, or not,
yeah.
I can't say for anybody, but it's a little more of a roller coaster ride.
Yeah. That's certainly the way it is described.
So I think there's an advantage of slowing it down and sort of smoothing it out if you're trying to explore it over, say, the roller coaster ride that is inhaled DMT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so while you were sort of, first of all, how long ago did that moment occur when you went up to your student and said, hey, I'm ready to learn?
It would have been about a year and a half ago.
Gotcha. Okay. So since then, so that's quite a condensed period of time to have tried all of these things. Are there more or would that be it?
That's pretty much it. I mean, I actually am growing some cactus, but that takes a very long time.
Oh, I'm sure it does.
So I don't anticipate trying the last of the classical psychedelics anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so it's been an adventure for the last year and a half. It has been an education. There are things, as I said, that I'm a little bit uncomfortable about. Well, one of the things I've observed is... Mm-hmm. And this makes people uncomfortable when I say this, but I mean it in a way that I don't think I think people don't always mean the term. I think in many ways, what I see in the psychedelic community is a nation religion. I don't mean it in the sense of, oh, we're going to have a Christian church with membership. And the fact is, religion historically, in the history of humanity, has been largely community-based, and you just are, and it arises of its own nature, and it's not top-down or hierarchical. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think that what I'm seeing it developing there is a actual 21st century religion, in that people have a shared set of beliefs, a shared set of goals. There's a lot of disagreement, of course, but that you'd expect that in any community. And the primary impulse of it is spiritual. I don't see why it should not receive exactly the same respect and protections as any other religion, because that's what it looks like. It looks like a bottom-up religion to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely, I think that is a very interesting observation, and I'd have to agree with you. There's definitely, there are elements that run very parallel to existing religions or even old religions that have sort of died out, gone away. There are lots of parallels that you can draw between that and the current set of communities that have grown around psychedelics and these shared values and the common goals and the common things that people are driven by, which are generally, personal growth and spiritual growth. And, it's a lot of doing the best we can and being the best version of ourselves and really trying to find a way to respect all of the things around us, which includes the planet and all the planet offers. And one of the things the planet does offer is plants that have these psychedelic effects on us. I personally find that such an interesting thing that we can pluck something out of the ground and ingest it and have this incredible experience and come away with insights that can then help us in our lives. I mean, that is truly, it's a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon to bear witness to. Love to know how in your experiences of, the microdosing with mushrooms and the pharmawaska and the DMT, what about these experiences has for you had a positive impact on you? What about it? What positive things have you gained from these experiences?
This is kind of difficult for me to discuss because I really have been, when I looked into all of this, I said, okay, I'm going to do it the right way, and I'm going to set an intent. And I did set an intent. And it was something that I've had sort of an outstanding problem in my life. I don't really want to get into it in depth is the catch here. But it was an outstanding problem that I've been dealing with for many, many years. And I've sort of been, I describe it as every now and then I look at it and poke at it and, look at the problem in my basement, poked at it with a stick, said, no idea how to solve this one, and then walked away. So I knew it was there, and I was not expecting any motion in that because, well, I was skeptical. I found motion. It does seem to prod things along. I can't say the problem is resolved, but I have to say I have made far more progress addressing it in a year and a half than I have spent, 40 years dealing with it. And even my student, who was a bit afraid that, you're going to be playing with this and, something's going to go wrong. And she was actually quite impressed with some of the changes that she saw in me, that it was actually, improving things.
Yeah.
In addition, though, I have to say the thing that most astonished me was the impact of pharmawaska on my joints.
Right. Yeah.
Because that was the last place I expected any sort of, effect. I mean, I was willing to concede that, yes, of course, here's this insight that popped out. That means there might be more insights that pop out. But I was not expecting health to pop out.
Right.
And as I said, there is some science behind the change, the improvement in my joint. I have to say, the temptation was, it was such a dramatic thing. The physical therapist I'd been working with, you know, couldn't help but notice how dramatically it had improved. And I was so tempted to say, oh, no problem, it was just ayahuasca. But I understood that that might not be, that discretion is sometimes the better part of valor. And at this point, it was necessary to be rather valorous, shall we say. I don't think that would go over very well. Put it in my medical record. I suspect that one would be a problem, which is unfortunate. I wish I could put that in my medical record.
And you never know. Maybe if these conversations happen more and really make their way into the mainstream, you never know. They might start to become recognized for some of their actual effects on our brain.
Yes, it would be nice if this was honestly, it'd be nice if these substances were looked at from a truly neutral position, you know, not, and that is the other thing I mentioned to you earlier, that where I start getting a little bit skeptical, and that is I do see people who seem to think that the solution is these substances, and they're merely tools. They're not going to solve all your problems. They're not going to make things all happen for you. And I do see people who they make a little bit of progress through a few insights they have. And the next week, it's like, well, I've got more things, progress I want to make. Let me use more drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I see a problem, because sometimes, and not by any means everyone, and in fact, I see a strong countervailing urge, you know, in the community not to do this. But I do see people trying to rely on the drugs for progress, especially spiritual progress.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just tools. They're not going to carry you all the way. And so rather than, you know, dosing and dosing and dosing, what this really is, it's sort of turning the normal mystical process is you grind at things, you work at things, you use insight, you meditate, you look at things, you talk to people, you work at it some more. You may make a little bit of progress here, a little bit of progress there. You're doing it very consciously, step by step. And then somewhere along the line, you may have a mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with these drugs, it's more like front-loading the mystical experience. If you take sufficient drugs under the right circumstances, you are very much inclined to have a mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
But now you don't have all that back work behind you. You just had this experience. And without the framework around it, it's not going to be retained. It's going to be, you're going to have amazing experiences, but no real progress.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
when people
go ahead.
Now, when people lean solely on the drugs and don't realize they've got to reverse engineer this. In essence, you're taking a mystical experience and reverse engineering the kind of transformation by going back and doing the same work. You know, I don't think it's a fast track to spiritual progress. Because I think what you have is you're going to be spending the same amount of time either way. The question is at what end? You know, at which point do you do the grinding work? Do you do the grinding work before, or do you do the grinding work in what people are calling integration? But you're still going to have to do it. It's not evadable. You can't evade that work. You can't evade looking at things and making them, you know, much more real and conscious. And you can't do it just by throwing drugs at your head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, you can have experiences that way. You can't have growth that way.
Yeah. Just to add to that, what I was going to say was that's probably why what's often the case is you have a sort of front-loaded mystical experience. And then, okay, so just I just wanted to add to that. That's probably why what's more often than not the case is you have this front-loaded mystical experience. And then when you walk away from that, it takes you a period of time to actually understand what happened and be able to look back and interpret the sort of symbolism that was present or the emotions that were present or just the entire thing. Being able to have an understanding of what occurred happens over time. And that's the case because you have to do the work to build that framework to actually hold these concepts and ideas in your body and in your mind. To be able to conceptualize them and to embody them, you have to do the work. You just do. There's no way around. And one of the things I thought of as you were speaking was that it's kind of like looking at these various plants or psychedelics as they're like apples fall from a tree. You can eat them and they can nourish you. You can look at them and you know, I don't know, enjoy the sight of them. You can share them. Sit under an apple tree, do all of these things. However, the apple itself is not the ultimate solution to life, and it will not give you the ultimate solution. What it will do is fulfill its very specific role and function within the ecosystem that is the planet. And so these plants, they have a very specific function and role that they could play. And that role is most certainly not getting you to spiritual enlightenment or getting you to where you are going in any way. What they can do, however, is be of some sort of assistance. And they can also be some sort of companion, just like the apple. If you like the sight of apples, they can certainly be a companion until they rot away, that is. But it's the same with these plants. They're a part of the planet. And we can interact with them as companions, as friends, and have a relationship and get to know them and allow them to get to know us. And in doing that, we can certainly gain tremendous assistance in our own life. And that's what's so incredibly powerful about these experiences. However, yeah, just to echo back what you've been saying, they are not the ultimate answer. And to tie that back into the interesting observation that you brought up, I have noticed in my experience that some people do tend to view them as that ultimate thing. And it becomes very religious, you know? And they start to plants like they are the ultimate sort of messenger or message from the planet or the universe and the way in which they're our salvation, if you will. And they're not. And that's something that we have to be careful as communities that are forming around psychedelics to remember that, hey, you know, we have to be very careful and we have to be aware of whether or not we're moving in that direction of starting to treat them like they are our salvation. Mm-hmm. And remembering that, hey, this is one of the many, many parts of this planet that we have to work with. And they are, like many other things, opportunities to understand ourselves better. Mm-hmm. That's what they offer. It's an insight into ourselves and into our planet. And, you know, that's what science is all about.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the way in which these substances, going with the science here being the way in which they were simply sort of thrown to the wayside for decades now without any decent research is kind of appalling to me. I do have a background in the sciences, and the more I look at it, it's like you almost have to willfully put on blinders to say there are no medical uses for these drugs, and therefore they're scheduled and you can't have them, and if you have them, you're a criminal. I mean, a criminal because you are wanting to understand the universe, or you're trying to deal with depression, or frankly, even you just want to go party that night because, well, that may not be my first impulse to do. I can't say that as long as someone is maintaining a reasonable safety, that that's the bad thing for them to do. It's not. It's their choice. It's not necessarily the way I live my life, but you know, if they're not driving under the influence, or doing something equally reckless, that's frankly none of my business.
So in the research that you've done, is there anything that sort of stood out to you that you didn't know about when you started to look at science behind psychedelics?
Virtually all of it I didn't know about, is I suppose the correct way to put it. Virtually all of it I didn't know. I didn't know the extent to which the research existed prior to their ban, on the basis of the existing research, that they should never have been banned if you believe that the scheduling really is of substances with no medical use, because they had already been actively used in medicine. You know, so these substances were being used, and then they just magically disappeared.
And why do you think that happened?
I think, frankly, that it was, at least I can really only speak of what I remember in the United States, because this occurred in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Granted, I was young, but I was already reading the papers and following the news. So, and I know what happened was, in part, people equated psychedelics with hippies, and hippies with radicals, and radicals with, you know, commies, and and threats to the sanctity of the Vietnam War, whatever that would be. And it seemed like the best way to get rid of those terrible hippie commies was to ban everything that these bad hippie commies were doing. But it was also complicated by the fact that there really was abuse of these drugs. I mean, by abuse, I don't mean that people become addicted. I don't know how you could successfully become addicted to a drug that doesn't let you take it very often. But if you tried, you would probably really dislike the experience. But abuse in the sense of using them in very unsafe ways. People were indeed, you know, using very large amounts in very uncontrolled settings. And frankly, I do recall watching Timothy Leary popping up on television all the time, and he was not the world's finest spokesman for these substances. And I think it just became sort of a political action. You know, of course, we have to get rid of these dirty commie hippies. So we have to get rid of the things they seem to be doing that are making them into dirty commie hippies from being good, you know, middle class, upstanding accountants or something, or whatever it was. I think it was a political, it was an issue. It was motivated for political reasons. And it was about as bad as any decision that's made largely on the basis of a moral panic. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of a moral panic. A moral panic is where you get, where a society develops this, some kind of fear or outrage or something that may not be based at all in fact. A classic moral panic example given to people in the West is the belief that if you have a fan blowing on, directly on you while you sleep in Korea, that that causes something called fan death, which, of course, there is no such thing as fan death. It's a cultural belief that isn't true. And nonetheless, that it's still widely held in Korea that you shouldn't have fans blowing on you, you know, directly. You know, in the West, they're one of the classic moral panics, and this is harder for people to understand because it's such an ingrained belief in our cultures, especially in the English-speaking culture, not necessarily other parts of the West, is that MSG is bad for you and causes all sorts of bad things. In fact, we are made of glutamate. We cannot react to it.
So a moral panic would be that on a large scale.
Yes. A society takes up a belief that is not true, that it nonetheless believes in many, and in many cases takes some pretty extreme reactions, you know, takes sometimes very extreme actions about. In the classic example of a moral panic in the West is the belief that MSG is dangerous.
Right.
The real story behind it was that it had been used widely in the United States and the rest of the English-speaking world for years, without anybody even batting an eye. I mean, I remember my mother pouring it on food. I mean, pouring would be a bit of an exaggeration, but you know what I mean. She was sprinkling it on, and it was just a part of a recipe there. And then suddenly, what happened was people started going to Chinese restaurants. And this was a time when there was a time when food was fairly impoverished. I mean, vegetables came out of cans. There was a hunk of meat on the plate. There was very little variety or flavor to, for example, the basic American diet. And suddenly people are going to Chinese restaurants for the first time. And between xenophobia and the terror of all these different shapes and colors and flavors, people would go into panic reactions in Chinese restaurants. Mm. And they looked around for what it was that they could blame. And because the Chinese usually spelled it out as monosodium glutamate, you know, as an ingredient. And there is a sort of underlying belief that chemicals by their chemical name must be bad. People quickly got the idea that it was monosodium glutamate that was responsible for were basically panic attacks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fear of unfamiliar food. We are made of glutamates. We really, really aren't. We don't. These studies have been run repeatedly. Monosodium glutamate is no more dangerous than any other spice we use.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But
yeah.
That's so ingrained in our culture that honestly, when I propose it, people are like horrified. No, no, no. I know people who react about it. Belief is a powerful thing. If you believe that monosodium glutamate is bad for you, you really can convince yourself of it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, another example,
yeah.
In the West a few years, but it was probably probably a decade ago now, was the infamous scary clown panic, which in the United States led to municipalities even banning people in clown suits at one point.
Wow.
Which was, as you watched it, it was a classic moral panic. And it was running through the country in this strange wave of terror of clowns. This is what a moral panic looks like. And there is no question in my mind that a lot of our anti-drug sentiment is basically powered by a moral panic.
Oh, yeah, you know, definitely.
What, you know, these things are terrible. What will happen to the, we must think of the children. Well, we should be handing them powerful drugs, but that's a general statement about drugs, whether legal or illegal. You don't hand them to your toddler to play with.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, there are actually a lot of cultures around the world where children do participate in ceremonies
yes,
with these plants.
Yes, but they're not merely handed them to play with.
No, absolutely not. They're not. Yep, no, it's definitely done with intention and for a reason, and they are certainly prepared for it
and
taught how to navigate.
Mm-hmm. And that, I think, also is a factor in why things sometimes go badly with psychedelics, although they go badly much less often than mythology would have it, is that people really have oftentimes had no idea what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are offered a drug at a party, you know, not the world's greatest setting, you know, and they don't necessarily know what they're getting into. And then it's a, you know, they panic. They've had their one bad experience. They tell everybody forevermore how horrible the drug was. And, you know, that further fuels the myth because we're not, you know, it's a little bit like handing a chainsaw to someone and saying, go at it, you know? Maybe they'll cut down the tree. Maybe they'll cut off their leg, you know?
And I can definitely. That resonates with me. I've certainly, when I was younger and first started to have experiences with specifically with mushrooms, I was not prepared, not equipped whatsoever. And, you know, my only idea of psychedelics came from my love for music from the 60s and 70s and you know, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. I knew that they loved acid or LSD, so I figured, hey, I'll probably love it too. And, you know, it was sort of me leaning into that sense of community with that hippie lifestyle of the 60s and 70s and wanting to feel like I was a part of it that got me interested in the first place. And you know, I was not prepared at all for the experiences, and I certainly went into it with intention. However, I didn't think about setting, and I didn't think about having a safe space. I didn't think about any of that stuff. I would just have them and then, you know, get in a cab and go wherever or go home. And I certainly had my fair share of amazing, you know, fun experiences as well as very difficult ones. Very, very difficult experiences that, I mean, it, for me, I count them as a blessing because they forced me to look at the seriousness of it all. That this wasn't something that I was to play with, and that was made very clear to me. But
yes,
with the intensity of the experience. So have you? I've only had one experience with DMT, and that was very, like you described it, it was a bit of a roller coaster. It was a lot happening at once, and I was surprised at the length of time the effects, I could still feel the effects because, you know, I had heard and I had read in various forums online that, you know, it only lasts about 5 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever. It's treated as this very short-lived experience where it wasn't that for me at all. It lasted probably a couple of hours at least. Hmm. Although, you know, not with the same intensity. It was, mm-hmm. certainly was not the same intensity, but I could feel the effects in my body. I could feel it in my body for mm-hmm. quite some time. And one of the things I like to bring up with people, because I think that this is such an interesting part of the experience, and it speaks to, you know, the various level of sensitivities that we all have. Every person has a different level of sensitivity, and every person reacts differently because that's just the way, you know, that's their makeup, mm-hmm. the makeup of their mind and their brain and what they're able to construct with the experience. So for me, they are very hallucinogenic. So the effects mm-hmm. for me are very much visual. It's not a whole lot. I talk to a lot of people who have no hallucinations at all. You know,
yes.
they could be ingesting just as much or even more, and they're not seeing any of the things that I'm seeing. Whereas mm-hmm. I'm kind of in a cartoon seven-dimensional world of some kind that looks nothing like the world that I'm used to every day. So it's a very different experience for me. Have you ever had experiences that were hallucinogenic, or did it ever feel like you sort of stepped into a different world?
I have very few visuals, mm-hmm. which is peculiar because I've heard of that happening with people who have a difficult time visualizing, and I don't. But I would imagine there's more reasons than just that one would have limited visuals. So I essentially have no visuals, none, on LSD. As I said, it makes me a little cheerier and a little dumber. You know, that's about all I notice. Actually, it would probably make a fine party drug for me because I really simply get a bit high from it. That's about it. Mm-hmm. Although I, as I said, my partying life, to the extent that it ever existed, doesn't exist now, and it never really existed that much. But in any case, I do get some visuals on mushrooms. I get my most visuals on DMT, which I suppose goes without saying, but less so than others report.
Mm-hmm.
So I get very few visuals. That's sort of I still get, you know, there are still definite mental changes, but they are not especially visual.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I've gotten far more visuals from edibles than I have ever gotten from a classical psychedelic. Don't ask me why.
That is fascinating. I wish there were more studies on that for exactly that reason, so we could understand why different brains react differently.
Oh, I think there's probably a lot to be learned there. And that's another example of where these substances actually could be not merely used to as a way of developing oneself personally, either spiritually or working out one's problems, but also as simple research tools.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not, you know, what makes this brain different from that brain? They respond differently to X. Let's see what happens if you, you know, put a marker on X and do a PET scan, you know. Let's see what the differences are. But obviously, with research being stymied for decades, we've never gotten around to using these as research tools, at least not to the extent that we really should be looking at them as research tools. But, you know, it so much was lost by the moral panic, which led to their ban.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the moral panic. Hopefully that'll dissipate with time. The attention will shift to another moral panic.
I'm sure there will always be moral panics out there. As long as humans are capable of being irrational, we will find something to freak out about. If it's not scary clowns, I don't know. It's going to be scary auto mechanics. I don't know.
Well, I mean, considering the current circumstances, I'd say that the moral panic currently is probably the pandemic, and whether that's, you know, the virus is real versus the virus is not real, that's a moral panic that lots of people are certainly attaching to.
You know, fundamentally, we are irrational people, and give us enough of a stressor and we will find ways of taking things irrationally, whichever way one leans. And that's just one of our features.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that may be one of the great strengths is that these meds are capable of helping one explore that irrationality in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And becoming more aware of the various irrationalities one might have.
Yes. Here's an interesting question for you. What do you think, and you know, this answer for you may be coming from a combination of your personal perspectives as well as research that you've done. What do you think these plants are? How, you know, why do they have these psychoactive ingredients?
Well, I know the current prevailing idea is that in some cases, these are actually made as insecticides of sorts, or more like insected deterrents.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact, for example, it's hypothesized that psilocybin causes some of the animals that prey on mushrooms to simply lose their appetite. So
wow.
It's an appetite suppressant. In other cases, like DMT, it appears to be an active biological thing that just so happens to, you know, it's an immunomodulator, a modulator of inflammation that the body actively uses it, but in trace amounts, normally because we are designed to scavenge it up as soon as it's there, we can simply, you know, we don't notice the psychoactivity because our body has plenty of MAO, you know, mono, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. I know I'm going to ruin it. MAOs, you know, inhibit that will sit there and scavenge it before the enzymes that will scavenge it before it ever builds up to anything close to a psychoactive in our systems naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we can defeat that by simply taking more of it, possibly in combination with an MAOI, possibly simply inhaling it or ingesting it in some manner that avoids the stomach where these enzymes exist. So I don't think there's one single reason. I mean, I'm sure the plants are doing it for their own reason. You know, they have a specific use for it. That said, that doesn't mean we can't find other uses for it. I'm fairly sure a tree has one idea as to what wood does. And we clearly, as we build our houses and furniture, have an entirely different idea of what wood is for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a great example. Have you noticed any other changes in your life since trying psychedelics, like perhaps with your dreams? Has it had an effect on being able to recall dreams or other parts of your life that you think have been changing?
I can't say I have, but I... Oh gosh, you know, I've unlike say your average person coming to it, I spent a lot of time in my head. You know, I've been I spent a lot of time, you know, in self-examination, in meditation, in that sort of thing, and there aren't a lot of completely unfamiliar corners in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I lack the enthusiasm, I guess, for dreams that many other people do. I generally remember them. Only rarely do I find one of significance. They're there. I wake up. There's a dream. I can't say I put that much emphasis on dreams. So I've not really looked at what dreams and what effects psychedelics are having on dreams.
Gotcha.
Kind of boring. What can I say?
No, it's not boring. It's an answer.
And I'm
content with your answer.
Okay, that's good because I lack the fascination with. I know a lot of people within the psychedelic community in particular are interested in lucid dreaming and similar things. I'm not really much concerned about that one way or the other. I mean, if a lucid dream occurred, I'd be interested in it. I don't feel a driving need to make them.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what? In having this conversation with you, I find it very refreshing because I get the impression that you've made your way into various communities and you've gotten to know psychedelics, and you haven't found yourself swept away by a set of ideals or a set of interests like lucid dreaming. So you've been able to kind of maintain this outsider observer role while also being and experiencing the things from within the community. I just think that that's very refreshing, and that offers an unbiased and objective look at things, which I think is very necessary. And personally, I appreciate it. I think it's very, very rad. I'm glad that you decided to do this and you shared your experiences and your perspectives. It's been very, very refreshing.
I realized that I had had a really seriously limited view of these things, especially since I was dealing with people who came to mysticism through the psychedelic world, you know, people who use these substances for a while and then, you know, for probably some very good reasons, for reasons of trying to integrate them into their lives, went more towards traditional mysticism. And I had simply been blinded to everything they had done in that way because I'd never seen through the propaganda. I was, back when other people were hippies, I was a nerd. What could I say? And it was not a part of my life, and I never really thought about it or considered it. And I just bought the lines, you know, and I realized something was not right with what I knew. And I needed to find out because this was not just peripheral. This was not just idle curiosity. I was dealing with people for whom this was an important part of their life. And I just was blind to it. I had to understand it.
Yeah. And now you are.
I'm trying to, at least. I make no claims to having fully understood what I'm looking at, but that's probably never going to occur.
Exactly. So long as there's progress, you are still learning. And yeah, I think that is fantastic. That's so great. Thank you so very much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
And that was Psychedelic Session number 4. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I hope you got some takeaways and learned some things. Please share, once again, share this episode, share this podcast, share feedback, comment from the guests on my podcast. Thank you for listening. And until next time, ciao.